From the studios of WEKU on the campus of Eastern Kentucky University, this is Eastern Standard. Hello, I am John Hingsberg, and we are in the middle of our fall fun drive. And for this week's Eastern Standard, we picked an appropriate topic and an appropriate guest to join us for the next hour. We have Jack Mitchell, author of Wisconsin on the Air, 100 years of public broadcasting in the state that invented it. And Jack is also the first paid employee of NPR. Jack Mitchell, thank you so much for joining us. You're at the studios of Wisconsin Public Radio in Madison, Wisconsin today.
Yes, I am. But I'm right with you.
Yes, you absolutely are. We're really grateful for, and thank you to the folks from Wisconsin Public Radio for making it possible to give us a good high-quality connection with Jack Mitchell during this hour. We may even talk a little bit about fundraising and support for public radio during this next hour. But Jack, I thought our listeners might be interested in knowing a little bit about your history, about your background, your role in developing public radio as we know it. Jack was director of Wisconsin Public Radio for 21 years. He was instrumental in the creation of one of our favorite programs called All Things Considered. He was the first employee of NPR. He's a Peabody and DuPont Award winner. Spent 12 years on the board of National Public Radio. He's the author of two books, the one that I just mentioned, and a book called Listener Supported, The History and Culture of Public Radio. And Jack is also professor emeritus at the University of Wisconsin Department of Media and Journalism. Jack Wilson, once again, thank you for being with us. Let's talk about how you got involved in public radio a few years back. When was it that you first got involved in public broadcasting?
My first job in educational radio was 1964. As it turns out, I was a part-time announcer at WUOM in Ann Arbor, which is hard to say, and it was the University of Michigan radio station. And one of the first things I did there, actually, was the night that Lyndon Johnson was reelected as president of the United States, November 1964, and inaugurated the Great Society, which was included many things, but the thing that most interested me was federal support for something called educational television, and which then added on radio later. But I was intrigued, you know, by this possibility. Here I was, you know, working as a student announcer at this radio station, but I could see the possibilities of a national system of as we eventually called it, public radio. So I made it a point over the next few years to sort of get ready for that. And I got in touch with some of the people who I thought would be leaders of this thing and wrote think pieces about what public radio ought to be. And eventually, when it came time to actually get going, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting sent me for 1 year to the BBC in London to find out how the real professionals do it, because nobody knew much about public. You know, public radio just kind of sailed along as part of the Public Television Act. There was a lot of enthusiasm for public television, but radio was, nobody really saw much potential in it. Radio had died for all practical purposes, and all the hopes were in public television. Well, I thought there was hope for public radio. In fact, I thought there was probably more hope for public radio than public TV. So I got myself in line to do this, and I'd known for several years I wanted to. And then when I came back from London, NPR was just beginning, and I waited around for a couple of months till they finally got their act together and selected a president. The first thing he did was hire me, and I opened the office in, it was August 15th, 1970. And he started a few weeks later. So for 3 weeks, I was National Public Radio.
Wow. And so what was that job description? Director?
I was called Program Associate or something vague like that. But I didn't do anything except, you know, answer the phone and set up meetings and did a lot of think pieces. That was sort of my function at that point.
On this week's Jack, let me just do a little reset, let folks know what's going on, and invite our listeners to be part of the show. Jack Mitchell is with us. Jack is the first employee of NPR. 1970 is when NPR began to formally exist. And Jack is with us on this week's Eastern Standard. And our show is an interactive show. On this Thursday morning, we are live, and we invite you to be part of the conversation by writing to us at wekueasternstandard@gmail.com. You can send a tweet at wekuest. Or give us a call. Now, we are inviting people to call and support the station at 800-621-8890. What I'm going to ask you to do to call Eastern Standard is to call 859-622-1664. That's 859-622-1664 to be part of this week's Eastern Standard if you'd like to interact with the gentleman who really helped to get this all started, and really he's had an impact on WEKU and an impact on hundreds of public radio stations across the nation by the efforts that he put in the early days of public broadcasting over 40 years ago. 859-622-1664. So, Jack, again, you came on the job there. You said it was August of 1970?
That's right.
And what started to happen? Now, let's talk about what began to develop once you came on the job.
Well, we had to assemble people, and so there was not a big pipeline of folks who had given any thought to what public radio ought to be. So we ended up with a lot of, cast-offs from public television. There were some very good people there, but folks who had actually had hoped to work in public television and for whatever reason ended up in radio. That was kind of awkward for me because I thought public radio had great potential, and these folks said, well, I guess we're kind of stuck with these jobs. But there was one individual named Bill Seemering, who was also from Wisconsin, by the way, and worked at WHA. And he, like me, had given a lot of thought to what this thing ought to be. And he was hired as program director and gave it a sense of vision of what we ought to be. So he and I worked very closely together, and I was a more pragmatic than he was. He was the big thinker, and I said, well, what time, what are we going to do at 5 o'clock tonight? And he would be more about however the impact we're going to have. So he and I worked closely together. We hired, and he basically hired people. And he did it not on the basis of qualifications so much as sort of a sense of talking to a person and would they fit in and do they really understand what this thing is all about. And so some very qualified people in many respects were turned down because they just were too commercial or didn't have the right mindset for what Bill thought a public radio service ought to be.
When you're starting a public radio service, what was the thought that you would create a certain number of programs, a certain number of hours of programming that would air every day? I mean, what was the first program, and how did NPR actually end up on the air on the stations across the country?
Yeah, well, we understood immediately that we could not do just a bunch of little programs, that they already existed. We had to do something big, and that would be the defining program for the organization. And even if we only did one program, we'd put all our resources into that. What was said is we need our Sesame Street, because public television was defined initially and put on the map by Sesame Street, a big, innovative, very good program, of course. And it ended up that we decided it needed to be a major magazine that would showcase all the different kinds of things that public radio ought to be doing. And it had no name, and then we didn't really know when. Some of us thought it ought to be on in the morning, because that's when most people listen to public radio or listen to radio at all. And very few people listen to public radio or educational radio in those days. But we decided that, that we should do this major program. Unfortunately, doing a program at 5 in the morning or 6 in the morning was more difficult than doing a program at 5 in the afternoon. And as a result, it was determined that we would do the program at 5 o'clock in the evening. and that it would not be 1 hour. It had to be more than an hour, because if it were an hour program, it would just seem it's a program. And this was supposed to be more of a service, and so it had to be more than an hour. We ended up making it 90 minutes. It probably should have been 2 hours, but we did 90 minutes because that's what we thought we could do. We had very few resources. We were, by public radio standards, we had tons of money, you know, but by a broadcast organization standards, there was very little. And we had a very small staff, and it was a very much seat-of-the-pants kind of thing for the first 5 or 6 years.
So where did the name come from?
Oh, I wish I could say that I thought of it. No, this was one of the great stories, or well, one of the facts, is that we did not have a name. And Bill Seemering put up a piece of paper on a wall and had people write suggestions. And his proposal was, "This is radio." That's what he wanted. We didn't want it to be a news program. We didn't want to call it the NPR Nightly News. It ought to be reflective of something much more, much broader than that. It would have news in it. It didn't need to be kind of contemporary, but not the day's news. So I suggested, "Give us this day," which I thought, well, that's kind of neat. It's kind of newsy, but not news. And it has a kind of a spiritual quality to it.
Kind of a lift from a very famous piece of writing.
Yes, I thought that was pretty clever. I was pretty proud of myself. And then somebody else wrote right underneath it, "Our Daily Bread," and which actually people liked better than "Give Us This Day." I couldn't believe it, but that was what they said. So for a while, that was the working title, "Our Daily Bread." And then at the very last minute, the day that the press release had to go out announcing the program, the chief engineer, who everybody in the programming department disliked because he was so formal and so rigid, and he wanted things to be precise and everything, you know, engineering. And, you know, it got to be spick and span, and we were pretty loose. This was 1970, by the way, you know, and it was all young people. It was a very informal programming group. And so he came up with this idea at the last minute, "Let's call it All Things Considered." And we all agreed. So here's this engineer came up with something better than the programming folks.
Named by the engineer. We're going to come back and learn more about the development of All Things Considered. And, think of what happened after that. Jack Mitchell is our guest on this week's Eastern Standard. Write to us by email, wekueasternstandard@gmail.com. Send a tweet at WEKUEST or call 859-622-1664. This is Eastern Standard on the WEKU stations. Hello, I am John Hingsbergen, and this week on our program, our interactive discussion features a guest who was instrumental in the creation of public radio as we know it, an appropriate topic and an appropriate guest during our fall fun drive at WEKU. As Roger and Sherry and Steve have mentioned on Thursday morning, 800-621-8890, the number we're asking listeners to call to support the station. And I am inviting you to call and be part of the program. You can call Eastern Standard directly by calling 859-622-1664, a little bit of a different number. This is a direct number into the program studio at 859-622-1664. Send us an email, wekueasternstandard@gmail.com. Send a tweet at WEKUEST. Jack Mitchell is with us, the director of Wisconsin Public Radio for 21 years, instrumental in the creation of All Things Considered, the first employee at NPR, a Peabody and DuPont Award winner, author of two books on public radio, professor emeritus at the University of Wisconsin. And a few moments ago, Jack told us that the name All Things Considered was created by an engineer at NPR, National Public Radio. Jack, you talked about this being something more than just a news show, it becoming a magazine. And you talked also about having spent a year at the BBC. So what's the connection there? Is that where you learned how to do a news or to do a magazine program?
Well, and the BBC did news magazines, but they were pretty conventional in the sense that they were serious. They were about news events, and they did a lot of different features and interviews and kind of a mix of things that actually a little bit more like what All Things Considered is today. But Bill Simmering did not see it that way. He thought that All Things Considered ought to consider all things that are of importance. And that included the arts. It also included the real stories of real people, and that we should hear from all kinds of people, not just the experts. And if you go back to look at the original documents that were written by board members and Simmering himself, it was to be a very democratic, participatory kind of service. Now, this ran counter to the instincts of a lot of people who were more of a public television background, and even some public radio types, who wanted the more formal news magazine. So I was experienced at the BBC doing the more formal news magazines, but I also understood what Simmering was getting at, is that we needed a showcase that covered all kinds of topics, including the day's news, not so much to report what happened today as to talk about it, to analyze it, to bring in experts who can explain things. So a little bit, those kinds of stories were sort of like what the NewsHour does on television. But Bill used to say, who says that the most important thing that happened today is what happened at the president's news conference? Maybe the most important thing that happened today was that some unemployed person got a job today. Let's tell that person's story and lead the program with that. Well, that was okay. We didn't do that, frankly. We did that much. And one of my influences was to actually increase the news emphasis on the program. But it was always to be news is only part of it, and then we do all these other things as well.
Now, All Things Considered, that first broadcast of All Things Considered was in May. Was that 1971 already?
Yeah, May 3rd, 1971.
After you were hired in August of 1970. That's pretty quick turnaround. It seems to me NPR takes more time now to create new programs than to create the very first production and the preeminent NPR program. You said it was too fast. Why too fast?
Well, we weren't ready. And it was, and maybe we never would have. I think a lot of people said we should have waited a couple more months or even another year, but I don't think that would have made too much difference. But the fact is that we didn't have our studios. We were just in an office building. And the engineers, we rented space in another office building across the street, and the engineers put together a very improvised studio. I'm sure that what you have at WEKU is a lot nicer and more professional than what we had then. But they did that in January, and that's when we started hiring people. Well, January, February, March, April, and then May 3rd, we were on the air. And the people we had, it was very, very loose. I mean, I think I indicated that before, but Simmering hired people who he thought were good people, but without job descriptions. And so it was just kind of a communal thing. We'd all kind of get together and decide what we're going to do that night. And we would, in fact, I used to say, and it's true, that what the program was depended on who was the first person to get in the morning, because they began to organize things and then it would kind of fall together. But there was no structure. We had, say, very primitive facilities. We had offices scattered all over this office building, so a couple of reporters might be in one office on one floor, and then another office, some other producer might be in another office on a different floor, and the studio's on a third place. It was just very, very unready. But we started, and it took several months to kind of come together. but eventually it did.
Tell us about some of the notable people that were hired early in the process. Who was hosting the program when it went on the air, and whom might our listeners recognize today who were among the early crew that that created All Things Considered?
Right. Okay. Well, the host was a man named Robert Connolly. The president of NPR was more conservative than Bill Simmering, and he wanted somebody who had credentials. Nobody on our staff had credentials. So we hired this guy who had been a foreign correspondent for NBC. He had worked at the New York Times prior to that as a foreign correspondent, an Ivy League graduate, very sophisticated individual. And he was the host. And he overcompensated for his professionalism, because he, getting into the spirit of Simmering, which was that we need to be conversational and kind of loose, he became extremely conversational and extremely loose and only partially competent. And it was kind of a mess, frankly. But Robert stayed around for several years. He was replaced as host, but stayed as a correspondent for a while. Another prominent person at the time was a fellow named Josh Darsa, who had been a CBS correspondent, who sounded a lot like Edward R. Murrow, and gave a lot of dignity to the place. And so he was a memorable person. But of those who were not famous at the time, the most important, I suppose, was Susan Stamberg, who was a mother. She had just had her first baby, her only baby, as it turns out, but she had a child, had moved back to Washington after having been abroad for a while, and had worked at WAMU, which was the American University station in Washington, not a very big operation. It is now, but it wasn't then, and came over as a tape cutter. And she only wanted to work 4 hours a day because she had a child who she needed to be home for. So she'd come in about 10 and go home around 3 and do tape editing and various chores that needed doing. But she was also, to my mind, the most interesting person, and she really understood what Simmering wanted. And then she had the right mix of informality and professionalism. So when I became producer of All Things Considered, I plugged her in as host. Okay, here's this 4 hour week part-time, 4 hours a day part-time person, but she was the best person we had. And so we plugged her in, and we had to rearrange her schedule and all that to keep so she could get home for dinner and this kind of thing. But that was, Susan was important. The other person of that sort was Linda Wertheimer, who had been done an internship at the BBC in London, as from Wellesley, I believe it was. And so she had some experience with radio, hard worker, very smart. And she was also hired as a tape editor. And what Connolly used to call the kids that edit tape, but she was really sharp, and of course eventually became host of All Things Considered, and of course one of the best reporters NPR has ever had. We had a fellow named Jim Russell, who was young, UPI, kind of a hard driving reporter, who had a great voice. And another fellow who Simmering brought along from Buffalo, named Mike Waters, who had a wonderful voice. And he, for a while, he replaced Connolly as host. And then Susan came in to join Mike. So they were there. Mm-hmm. And then Ira Flatow, who was also from Buffalo. He came with Simmering. And he was a tape editor. And he wanted to be on the radio, and he was interested in science. And he had a terrible voice, and he sounded young, and he didn't sound professional. So I, for a long time, kept him off the air. He said, "You're not going to be on." And Simmering agreed with me. "You can't be on the air, Ira." And so we had him setting up other science people to come on the air and do things. And he'd say, "I know more than that guy. Why don't you let me do it?" And finally, he did get on the air. And of course, he's now host of Science Friday, which I don't know if you carry it there or not, but it's a very good science program that he's done. He did Newton's apple on television. He went on to great things.
Well, our listeners certainly recognize some of these names that Jack Mitchell is mentioning. Jack Mitchell is not necessarily a household name among public radio listeners, but he is the original, the very first employee of NPR back in 1970, and one of the creators, one of the people who helped shape the sound of public radio as we know it today. This is Eastern Standard on the WEKU stations, and we encourage you to be part of our program on this Thursday morning. We're still live for the bulk of another half hour. 800-621-8890 is the number we're asking you to call to support the station during this fall fund drive, but to participate in this week's Eastern Standard. If you'd like to get in to the program directly, you can reach us at 859-622-1664. 859-622-1664. Send us an email, wekueasternstandard@gmail.com. Send a tweet at WEKUEST and be part of our program. What are your questions about the early days of NPR and public radio, at the development of public radio as we know it? What are your insights, your stories? What has public radio meant to you over the years? When did you first start tuning in? Do you remember Robert Connolly hosting All Things Considered? What do you think about that young tape cutter, Susan Stamberg, when she began to take over the program? 859-622-1664. Jack Mitchell, I know there's a story about how the newscasts developed at the top of the hour. So All Things Considered was the first broadcast, so there were no hourly newscasts throughout the day that stations along the way could pick up?
No. Oh, no. That was too commercial. We, you know, CBS did hourly newscasts. So did NBC. We were very concerned about being an alternative to what was available. And what was available wasn't that bad. I mean, CBS Radio News was actually very strong. You know, this was Murrow and Cronkite, and, you know, that's, you know, a classic bunch.
And I think in the early 70s, ABC had four newscasts per hour at one point.
That's right. That's right. NBC was good. They had, you know, they were all the three major networks were quite strong. And we did not want to duplicate that, and that, you know, we'd never even considered hourly newscasts. So the original All Things Considered, news was part of the program, but it did not lead the program necessarily. There was one newscast sometime in that 90 minutes. And my first, one of my jobs at the beginning and the first several weeks of shows was to do the newscast. And it turned out to be in, maybe at 5:45, you know, 45 minutes in. Meanwhile, they're talking about other things, but the newscast was definitely downplayed. Eventually, when I became producer, when I took it over, I decided, you know, we need to start on the with a newscast at 5:00 and then again at 6:00. So we would have two, and they would start a minute after the hour because we need time for the introduction. And so that sort of lasted. But it wasn't until many years later that the hourly newscasts were added, that you now are a trademark of the organization. And in a way, that's good because the commercial news has declined so much. And it's, you know, CBS News is a shadow of it once was. And NBC News is gone on radio. And so it's a, you know, it's now serving a purpose. We are still an alternative, but the reality, what we're an alternative to, has changed.
So that newscast at a minute past the hour sort of lasted, like, yes, it's there 24 hours a day, and NPR
and a minute late.
Yeah, a minute late, and by accident of the needs of the program in which it was created, as opposed to the commercial networks where they do the news straight up, where they did the news straight up at the top of every hour. Jack Mitchell is our guest on this week's Eastern Standard. We're going to take another short break in just a few moments as we ask listeners to support WEKU during the fall 2016 fund drive. I guess, Jack, you've probably been involved in a fund drive or two yourself.
Oh, yes. I know how to do it.
Why don't you, you've got 30 seconds to make a pitch to our listeners, if you would. Could you do that for me right now?
Well, I wish I knew the phone number, but you can handle that.
I'll do that.
This public radio has initially was supported by government. But that never has amounted to enough to, and it's been reduced over the years. So now listeners have taken over and have kept alive and made this organization continue to grow because of listener support. And it's not just everybody, it's you. I mean, it's the individual, every individual who listens makes that choice.
That's a pitch from the original employee of NPR, Jack Mitchell. Thank you, Jack. 800-621-8890, the number we're asking you to call. It's Eastern Standard on the WEKU stations. I'm John Hingsburg, and with our guest this week, a special guest, Jack Mitchell, director of Wisconsin Public Radio for 21 years, the first employee of National Public Radio, involved in creation of All Things Considered, the first newscaster during All Things Considered. And he's here with us for the rest of this hour, for the rest of this week's Eastern Standard, live on Thursday morning. And you are welcome to be part of the conversation with your questions, your comments, your stories about what All Things Considered or this NPR programming has meant to you over the years. 859-622-1664. Thank you to those who've been calling in and supporting the station. We'd like to hear from a couple of folks who might like to talk with Jack Mitchell. We have our producers standing by to take your call at 859-622-1664. Send us an email, wekueasternstandard@gmail.com, or send a tweet at WEKUEST. They didn't have Twitter. They didn't have email when Jack Mitchell started at NPR. But, Jack, can we talk? Were there some innovations in media, in radio, in broadcasting that NPR developed? I'm thinking in terms of sound-rich reporting, and I'm thinking of live updates during anti-war protests during the Vietnam War that were part of the programming on NPR.
Yes, well, we were very much the leader in developing documentary-style programming. Prior to this, a reporter would read a script, maybe stick in one little insert from some newsmaker, but it was essentially a print-oriented. Journalism was print-oriented, even on the radio. And so you wrote scripts, you read them. And in the case of Siemering believed, and many others, of course, came to believe it too, that radio could be use sound to tell stories, and that you would go out into a situation and record the voices of the people involved, but also the sounds of things happening, which in a way was what television was doing, where they would go out and film events that are happening and then put it all together into a package. And so radio hadn't done that in this country, or even the BBC, which was very strict in its kind of a print orientation. And when NPR started doing programming like this, and there was a fellow named Jeff Kamen, who was probably the best at it, and there were two or three others. Ira Glass, who was not there at the beginning, but he certainly pushed that in a big way
and became relatively well known in public.
Yes, he did. But he was another tape cutter at NPR, and he worked with Robert Krulwich and developed some great stuff. But it was interesting going backwards. The BBC, after hearing what NPR was doing, started adapting those same techniques. So the mother of public broadcasting, which I was sent over there to learn how to do it, ended up copying us. And I was kind of pleased about that.
Well, some of us have very, very vivid memories of NPR's coverage of, live coverage of reports of protests in the streets of Washington, D.C. Were you there during those days? What was the situation that caused for these live from the street broadcasts?
Yeah. Well, actually, that wasn't live. If you're talking about the very first broadcast where it was a major demonstration, a march on Washington, to protest the war, the Vietnam War. And it was supposed to be May Day, May 1st, 1970, but because May Day was on a Saturday and their goal was to disrupt the government, they waited till Monday, which was May 3rd, the day that we started. This is that technique that we had about four reporters who went out into the demonstrations and recorded the sound of these things happening. And then they brought the tape back and then put it all together in a very short time frame. It was really quite miraculous the way they did it. And put together this montage, really, of the scenes. And it sounded live, but in fact it wasn't. And so it's very much, it was an edited operation. But sound was the key to it.
In 1983, NPR went through a financial collapse. Where were you when that occurred? And what can you tell our listeners today about that? And I understand that in that situation, I mean, stations came to the rescue of NPR. And from the very beginning, I know NPR was funded to a great extent from fees that stations paid in. I guess stations today, we receive fees from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, which we then pretty much quickly turn back around and send to NPR, to Public Radio International, to American Public Media, and other program providers. Was that part of the initial structure? And tell us about you know, the stations coming to NPR's rescue in 1983.
Yeah. Okay, that's very very important turning point. Prior to 1983. NPR was funded almost totally by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Directly.
They would send it. That's right. They sent a check. In fact, one day we were opening the mail and All Things Considered, and there was an envelope from CPB, and you opened it up, and it was a check for $1 million.
who got to work early that day to open
right.
that letter?
Right. So we, but that's how it came. We got several $1 million a year from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. And then in the late 70s, we had a new president who was a real dynamo, a fellow named Frank Mankiewicz, who believed that good programming ought to be done and money ought to be spent whether or not you have it, because it's quality, it's good. And so the place went into debt, deep into debt, and was essentially bankrupt. I happened to have been elected to the NPR board 2 months before the auditors discovered the problem. And I was shocked. I couldn't believe it. And everybody else was, too. So we ended up having to bring in new management. And it turns out it was another person from Wisconsin. And I went back as head of programming for several months during this time, and my main job was to cut things that we had built. Now I can't cut them. But out of all this, CPB said, we're not Corporation for Public Broadcasting. We're not going to send them checks anymore. And so they decided at that point that the money would go to the stations, and then the stations would pay NPR. And the stations had to take responsibility for NPR's operations. So the stations became much more important to the organization in terms of just the control of NPR as well as the financing of it. But we just changed the whole thing because it could have operated as it had been, but in fact they had operated irresponsibly. And then a new management came in and was extremely responsible and straightened the place out. And then the idea that the stations should pay for it became central to the whole operation. And if the stations are paying for it, well, who pays the stations? Well, CPB pays them something, but listeners come to the rescue. So in a way, now listeners support the local radio station. The local radio station pays for NPR, which I think is a much healthier arrangement than what we had when CPB just wrote us a check and sent it to the wrong address.
So in a very similar manner to we at stations like WEKU asking listeners to donate individually to make the station possible, now NPR and the program providers rely on the stations to provide that support. So it's a kind of a multi-tiered situation of membership. mothership. So really, stations are members of NPR. NPR is not the mothership, the network to which we belong, but it's really an organization that is made up of the participating stations.
That's right. The stations own the network, and listeners, of course, own the stations by not legally, but by the support that they provide. So you get listeners' support to the stations, that turns around and supports the programming that everybody respects so much.
Jack Mitchell, you are the author of two books. I know about 10 years ago you did one, Listeners Supported, The History and Culture of Public Radio, and this most recent, Wisconsin on the Air, 100 Years of Public Broadcasting in the State That Invented It. Let's talk about the significance and the importance of Wisconsin in the field of public radio. Many of our listeners are familiar with programs that have come out of Wisconsin Public Radio, but wow, there's you got a couple hundred pages on Wisconsin Public Radio, and I know you were the director of Wisconsin Public Radio for 21 years and played a part in that history. What's the message, and what's the core of this latest book?
Well, the beginning of radio broadcasting, which means broadcasting voice and music, not just Morse code, because they'd been doing Morse code for a long time. But in 1917, for the first time in the University of Wisconsin, physicists broadcast voice and music. And that was the beginning of broadcasting to the broad public in this state and really around the country.
Not just public radio, non-commercial radio as we know it today.
Right. But the key, and that's important and kind of interesting, but for me the most important thing is the so-called Wisconsin idea, which is a big deal up here. Probably not, you've probably never heard of it in Kentucky, but it was the notion of a university reaching the entire state, that the students on campus, that's nice, but the most important function of the university is to serve all the citizens of the state. So it made sense that the university would use radio to reach beyond the campus. And this is probably the first place that understood that and actually put major resources into doing that. Other universities did get into public broadcasting, but it came later and with less of a sense of purpose than was here. It was central to the mission of the university, and in most places, public radio is kind of peripheral to the mission of the institution.
I mean, for some years, many universities did consider their public radio station at the core of their mission, their outreach efforts and so forth. I mean, that does seem to have slipped away in a lot of university minds. How do you feel about that? About that change? Have the universities lost something valuable by giving up on that commitment?
I think so, and I think the public has lost something. I would say, though, that the values of the university, you know, the notion that we care about truth and balance and discussion, those permeate public radio, even though the ties to the universities themselves have diminished somewhat. But the notion, I believe that the values of public broadcasting are essentially academic values, and that the notion that the people here in Wisconsin had back in 1917 was that you could take these values, these techniques, these things that universities stand for, and apply them to all kinds of issues outside the classroom. And so the notion of debates about politics and accuracy in news reporting, these are values that are still there in public radio, and it really began in universities.
Can you think of some ways that university radio moved ahead? I mean, as it was educational radio at the time, a lot of the broadcast, as I understand it, may have been classes or lectures, right, and standard kind of university activities and events. Was there a point at which all of a sudden it clicked and it became something different than just recording and broadcasting things that might otherwise happen on campus?
Well, in Wisconsin, and this is what I think is interesting, is that from the very beginning, they did not see classroom and credit courses and these kinds of formal education is what they were about. It was to reach the general public with an approach to solving problems. And that was not formal classes. Now, over time, formal courses did get on the air here and in a lot of other places. But to my mind, that was never the point. And it disappeared beginning with the Public Broadcasting Act, which was 1967, when the National Carnegie Commission on Educational Television, it was called. But it said specifically that public broadcasting exists to serve the general public and not formal education. That was very controversial when it happened, but it was the right decision. And it went right back to the original notion of educational broadcasting as conceived in 1917 here in Madison.
So how is the book doing? It was released, I guess, earlier this year in 2016?
Well, I don't know for sure. I got a royalty check the other day, so I guess somebody bought it.
Oh, that's a good sign.
But no, I really don't know. I've certainly received a lot of nice feedback about it. But in terms of how many are being sold, it takes them a long time to count that up. And so I really don't know, but I think it's doing okay.
The book is Wisconsin on the Air, 100 Years of Public Broadcasting in the State That Invented It, by Jack Mitchell, published copyright by the State Historical Society of Wisconsin. We have just a few minutes remaining with Jack Mitchell, the original employee of NPR and one of the creators of All Things Considered as we know it. You're welcome to be part of the show if you can get on the line quickly, 859-622-1664. That's 859-622-1664. But before we hear from a listener, Jack, what are you thinking about how NPR has developed over the years? The baby, the creation you were part of giving birth to, in 1971, has expanded a little bit, and it's had a few additional offspring in other programs. How are you feeling about the health and the development of public radio? Is it going the direction you thought it would?
It's different. It's not what I had envisioned. It's far more successful than I thought it would be. I was under the impression, the assumption that we were an alternative to a healthy commercial media system. And we were going to be dancing around the edges and doing things in a different way, emphasizing different things. Over the years, NPR has developed into not only an alternative to commercial media, it's replaced commercial media as a news gathering organization. There's nobody better. CBS is not as good. There's nobody other than perhaps the BBC, that does news, particularly international news, more thoroughly than NPR. We spend a lot of money on these services, things that we couldn't have even conceived of at the beginning, because we didn't have any foreign correspondents at the beginning. We had three or four reporters in Washington, and that was about it. So the reporting capacity is huge, and to say it's unlike anything else, that was totally not what I anticipated. I'm not saying it's wrong, but it's a marvelous service. And given that the media, how they have changed, and the lack of really strong reporting in most media, certainly most broadcast media, it's an essential service, but it's not what we started out to be.
How are you feeling about the future of radio as a medium and the fact that so much of what we do now, we think in terms of content, we think in terms of material that ends up on smartphones and on websites and gets consumed in all kinds of manners. Is that a logical extension of what NPR was created to be?
No, not actually, because one of the things that, and it's not, once again, not necessarily bad, and whether or not it's good or bad, it's inevitable. So we will need to adapt to that. But NPR's idea was, and this was Bill Siemering, is that radio, even back in the 1970s, was very format-driven. So you had a black station in a community, and you'd have a country station in a community, and you'd have a kind of a middle-of-the-road, and you'd have a teenage station. You'd have, half a dozen or so stations aimed at different audiences. And Siemering's hope was that we would have a service that would appeal to everybody, that would be out there, anybody. It may not be your first choice, but it might be a second choice of a lot of people who would listen to their own station. But it was a place to come together where the country listener could hear the same thing that the person who normally listens to the black station would hear. And of course, that was not realistic when it came right down to it. But now the podcasting world and the idea of everything being even more segmented, this notion that we have a place that everybody comes together is being lost. And I think that's very unfortunate. But in what's coming out of it, though, is that public radio, with its production capacity, its ability to produce quality programming, it reaches a certain kind of listener, not as broad as Siemering wanted, but a certain type of listener who cares about quality, and they will be reached by whatever means is the technology of the day. It may be podcasts, it might be broadcast, but the quality is really what matters, and that's where NPR cannot be replaced, or public radio in general can't be replaced.
Jack Mitchell has been our guest on this week's Eastern Standard, a fascinating conversation. Jack is the author of Wisconsin on the Air, 100 Years of Public Broadcasting in the State That Invented It. Our Sunday evening listeners will hear more about that book when they tune in for the repeat of the show, and you can hear it on the podcast as well. Jack Mitchell joined us from the studios of Wisconsin Public Radio in Madison, Wisconsin. Thank you so much for being with us for this week's Eastern Standard.
Oh, I enjoyed it.
Thank you, Jack Mitchell. Thank you to our producers, Grant Wilby, Marissa Hempel, and Brian Burkhart. I'm John Hingsbergen. Thanks for being with us for Eastern Standard on the WEKU stations.